the Tamale King of Sheridan, Wyoming, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. His name was Zarif Khan, and he left South Asia more than a century ago to start a new life.
By 1909, this young man from 12,000 miles away had set up shop selling, of all things, hot tamales in Sheridan, Wyoming.
The story of Hot Tamale Louie coming up. Plus, Harry Potter gets reimagined for the London stage, and a black actor is cast as one of the leads. There's been vitriolic, even racist backlash.
I understand and I respect people being protective of their favourite characters. The Harry Potter series has been something that a lot of us have grown up with, the films and the books, so I understand. But they need to chill out a bit.
Those stories ahead on The World. Sometimes the line between domestic and international politics gets really blurry. We're starting the show today with an example of that. A couple of days ago, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced an executive order. If you boycott against Israel, New York will boycott you, he said. The executive order requires state agencies to divest all public funds from any company or individual with ties to the movement known as Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS. Matthew Duss is the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. He says on some levels, the boycott campaign hasn't been very effective.
The actual economic impact has been fairly minimal. I think there was a report in Bloomberg News the other day that showed that foreign investment is actually increasing in Israel rather than decreasing. But I think that's only part of the story, I think, in terms of symbolic impact. The BDS movement has had a considerable amount of success, and let's recognize that symbolism is a big part of politics. Prime Minister Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders have clearly identified BDS as a threat. They make speeches about it all the time. The Israeli government has committed a lot of money to fighting BDS, and I think Governor Cuomo's statement, the fact that the governor of the state of New York sees BDS as big enough of a deal that he has to issue this executive order is another testament to that.
His executive order is a divestment, and it's requiring New York State to divest itself of public funds from any company or individual with ties to BDS, meaning companies that are boycotting Israel. So it's a kind of protest of a protest, isn't it?
Right. It is very odd. It's saying that boycotting Israel is inappropriate, so we are going to boycott you in response. Governor Cuomo himself issued an order limiting official travel to North Carolina in response to their law, their anti-LGBT law. So I think in this case, we have two different responses to movements that are using economic pressure to change policy.
Are you concerned that Governor Cuomo's executive order will succeed in delegitimizing the boycott?
I'm not necessarily concerned about that. If anything, I think it's raised awareness and caused even people who don't pay attention to these issues to sit up and say, wait a minute, what's going on here? I think the fact that Governor Cuomo did this after the New York State legislature considered and decided not to pass a measure like this because they were warned by civil liberties experts that it simply would not pass legal muster, the fact that he picked this up and issued it as an executive order has caused some people to question whether it's actually a legitimate, appropriate exercise of his authority.
Some supporters of the executive order, they're calling the boycott sort of a form of anti-Semitism, that it's really the demands effectively are saying that if you read the beliefs of the people who founded the boycott, that they really don't believe in a Jewish state to begin with. How do you respond to that?
I would say clearly there are some people who are part of the BDS movement who believe those things and have said those things, things that I personally would consider offensive and I would not agree with and I would disagree with them publicly and have done so. But I think the answer to that is not to make economic protest illegal. The way to deal with that is to actually argue and debate these issues openly. And I would also say when looking at the executive order, it's very important to consider what it does not mention. It does not mention the word occupation. And I think to consider the BDS movement without even addressing the fact that this movement is driven by the desire to end a nearly 50-year – and actually this week we enter the 50th year of this occupation in which over 4.5 million Palestinians live under military rule with no real democratic representation. That is what's driving this. And I think to address the BDS issue without acknowledging that is a real mistake.
What do you think of the implications of Cuomo's order? Could it extend to student organizations or even state universities being stripped of state funds if they issue statements supporting BDS?
legal experts are looking into that now. I think that is a clear implication here. I think one of the real problematic things about it is that it essentially creates a list and causes these organizations and individuals who are so named to basically argue for their own innocence to demonstrate that they are not crossing this line. So that is only one of the whole set of, I think, legal problems that arises here. We have a long history in this country of using economic protest. I would note, it's very important to note, this is a nonviolent form of protest. So for punishing people for expressing these views and using nonviolent means to change policy, I think brings us into some very dangerous territory.
Matthew Duss is the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.
For a different take on Governor Cuomo's divestment order and the debate in New York, we turn now to Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League.
Governor Cuomo has a history of standing up for the Jewish state. And I think he believes, like we believe, that the originators of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign seek to delegitimize Israel on the basis of really some anti-Semitic ideas. And so this campaign, which seeks to delegitimize and demonize Israel, Israeli academics, Israeli companies, Israeli civilians, Israel in general, he thinks is the wrong way to approach creating change in the region and driving toward a peaceful resolution of the longstanding Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Charging the movement with anti-Semitism is a pretty strong charge. What's the evidence?
Well, if you look at Omar Barghouti and the architects of the BDS movement, they've been very clear about the fact that they don't believe in the notion of the Jewish state of Israel. They don't believe in the right of Jewish self-determination. They believe in that right for Palestinians, as do we, frankly. We at Israel believe in a two-state solution. But suggesting that Israelis don't have the very basic right to nationhood that is literally acknowledged or exists for all other peoples on the planet, marginalizing Jews in that way, we think that's anti-Semitic.
But the point of the BDS is really focusing on occupation, focusing on creating a two-state solution. It's not, at least my reading of it, and when I look at the people who are supporting it, it seems to be a mix of people, including Israelis and including Jews who don't live in Israel.
Well, it's funny. There certainly are some Israelis and some Jews who don't live in Israel who support it. But if you actually look at the movement, if you look at its origins, and if you look at its goals, it does not support a two-state solution. It does not support the right of Jewish self-determination, and it is explicitly not about the Jewish, or excuse me, Israel and its quote-unquote occupation of the West Bank. That is not what it's seeking to resolve. Again, if you look back at what their goals are, and they're pretty explicit about it in its origins, but on campuses, or when pushing a Protestant religious denomination to divest its endowment, or when talking about businesses, they don't highlight the fact that they seek to repatriate every single Palestinian refugee into the Jewish state of Israel. And I will tell you, they don't highlight the fact that they don't believe in a Jewish homeland on Jewish ancestral land.
The legal director of the nonprofit Center for Constitutional Rights, he's really equating Cuomo's actions with McCarthyism, you know, identifying organizations that are engaging in speech we don't like and blacklisting them.
It's interesting because that technique of boycotting and blacklisting people on the basis of what you don't like reminds me of the BDS movement, which seeks to bar people on the basis of their nationality from doing business, from, again, attending a conference, from having their research published. It's McCarthyite to the core. Now, unfortunately, where I think that comparison falls apart is this, you know, Governor Cuomo's executive order is trying to prevent this BDS movement from growing. The BDS movement seeks to eliminate the Jewish Democratic State of Israel. I think that's a much more problematic prospect. And then secondly, I think we here at the ADL, and I can't speak for all your listeners, I can't even speak for you, but we at the ADL deeply, profoundly are committed to a two-state solution. That's why we talk about it all the time.
Well, my final question is about that. I mean, if you think the BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is a counterproductive way to protest Israeli policy, what is a productive course of action?
That's a great question. So I think there are a lot of things that could be productive. So number one, the best way I think to help the Palestinian economy is not by divesting from Israel, but investing in the Palestinians. Not by boycotting Israeli businesses, but by buying from Palestinian businesses. Not by sanctions, but by startups. So I think there's a line of action that's available to Americans and other people who want to support Palestinian self-determination that involves supporting and strengthening the Palestinian economy and encouraging the Palestinian Authority and the Hamas government in Gaza to take measures to support it. Secondly, like, look, there's lots of opportunities. We believe in a two-state solution. Make sure your political candidates, make sure your elected representatives are pushing for that as well. That's the best way we can resolve this issue for the benefit of Palestinians and Israelis.
Jonathan Greenblatt is CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. He joined us from New York. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
It's Modi time in Washington, as in Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India. Today, he was at the White House to meet President Obama. Modi is an interesting guest. 11 years ago, the U.S. denied him an entry visa over his role in the 2002 Gujarat riots that killed more than 1,000 Muslims. Modi, who was a Hindu, was then a top official in Gujarat. Now he's on his fourth visit to the U.S., and he refers to President Obama as my close friend. I asked Nisit Hajjari, Asia editor for Bloomberg View, if that closeness is for real.
Modi has an interest in showing to his population back home that he's particularly close with Obama, that the world's most powerful leader, you know, embraces him in an almost brotherly fashion. But they're very different men, and it's hard to say, you know, unless you're in the room with them, exactly how genuine the friendship or the rapport is. What's clear is that both the U.S. and India have such strong interests pulling them together that almost any two leaders would be pursuing this relationship right now.
What does Modi want out of this trip?
I think Modi wants a couple things. In the strategic sense, he, like the U.S., is concerned about the rise of China within Asia. And partnering with the U.S., particularly in defense, helps him counter that, helps both countries counter that. And also, they're not just talking about military coordination and joint exercises and things like that. They're talking about co-producing weaponry in India, and that's would provide a big boost to his campaign, which he calls Make in India, to create a real manufacturing sector in India.
Do you think that the issues Obama and Modi will discuss and possibly agree on in this visit, are they likely to carry over to the next American president, whether it's a Democrat or Republican?
I think so, particularly on the defense front. I mean, these are measures that we're talking about right now, this sort of co-production and logistics agreements and so on. You know, these are somewhat technical things. They're not ideologically based, and they are definitely within the interests, security interests of the United States.
Prime Minister Modi, has a particular style as a prime minister. He's a fairly forceful presence. Do you see any similarities between him and possible Republican President Donald Trump?
You hear that parallel a lot. It's interesting. You know, these are two men, you know, I suppose you could call them both nationalists in a way. You know, Modi is not an isolationist by any stretch. And the great criticism of Modi, you know, coming into office was that he was a diehard Hindu nationalist, a longtime member of a sectarian group called the RSS that had promoted a sort of Hindu first version of India, sort of, you know, strong majoritarianism. And that's something that people see within Donald Trump's approach as well. You know, I think the more telling parallel is that since Modi's been in office, you know, he's been careful himself personally not to say anything, do anything that would promote intolerance. But it's a fair criticism that he's allowed an atmosphere to develop.
Nisit Hajjari is the Asia editor for Bloomberg View. Thanks, Nisit.
Thank you very much.
This is The World. In the early 1900s, a young man set off from his village in South Asia. He didn't have a set plan, but he ended up here in the United States, specifically Sheridan, Wyoming. And he became very successful there, cooking for a living. His specialty wasn't the traditional food he grew up eating in South Asia. No, he was really good at making tamales. So good, in fact, that he was given the nickname Hot Tamale Louie. We learned of this classic immigrant success story from Catherine Schultz. She wrote about it for The New Yorker.
Surprisingly, given the nickname that he was known by all of his life, Hot Tamale Louie was an immigrant from the borderlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan, whose real name was Zarif Khan. We don't know a whole lot about his very early years, but we know that as a young man, he left the small village he was from and made his way by ship, probably via Hong Kong, San Francisco, and Seattle, to the coast of the United States, and then through to the interior via South Dakota and landed in Sheridan. Now, the question of why there exactly is one of the black holes of this piece and one of the really interesting ones. We don't know, again, a lot about how he got there. We just know that by 1909, this young man from 12,000 miles away had set up shop selling, of all things, hot tamales in Sheridan, Wyoming.
Why hot tamales? You certainly don't think tribal lands of Afghanistan when you hear the word tamale.
No, and you don't even think Sheridan, Wyoming when you hear the word tamale. That was really the million-dollar question of my piece, almost until the very end that I was reporting it. Why is this man from Afghanistan selling tamales? And the answers that everyone locally had, including Zarif Khan's children and other relatives, were, oh, you know, we think he met a Mexican immigrant somewhere along the way, and that person taught him to cook, or maybe he actually lived in Mexico for a while, none of which turns out to be true, as is so often the case. The reality is much more fascinating, which is that Zarif Khan's life happened to intersect with this strange boom in tamale sales in the United States between about 1895 and 1915 or 20 or so. There was this absolute craze for hot tamales. It started at the Chicago World's Fair and gradually spread around the country. And so for a while, if you were new to the country or poor and wanted to start a business but couldn't afford a lot of overhead, a good way to earn some money and achieve some success was to start peddling this hot new food item, the tamale.
Now, what's interesting is Hot Tamale Louie makes his way to Wyoming, but then he stays there, you know, really for the rest of his life. What kept him there?
My best guess, and one that I think would be seconded by everyone who knows him, is that what kept him there is he found a really wonderful life. Sheridan, Wyoming in 1909 was shockingly cosmopolitan. In some ways, it was more diverse and kind of bustling than it is even today. He was running, of course, this tamale shop. There were Chinese restaurants. There was a Polish community, an Italian community. The railroad went through there. And of course, the railroad was still really the kind of bloodline of the American nation at that point. He was so widely loved by the time of his death that even now, 60 years on, truly anyone over the age of 50 that you stop and talk to in Sheridan can tell you stories about him. So I think he stayed because he was loved. And you know, when you are loved, it is easy to love a place.
And certainly his food was loved. People still talk about it.
And his food was extraordinarily loved. Yes, it's true. It's really fun listening to people reminisce about it. I mean, this place, by all accounts, was truly kind of a dive. I mean, just a real hole in the wall, kind of off of Main Street in Sheridan. And yet the burgers and tamales that this man made, he started with tamales, and when he opened up a little restaurant, added hamburgers, among other things, to the menu. And truly, it's, you know, when people talk about them, it's like, you know, they're all but salivating. The memory of this food is obviously just absolutely enchanting to anyone who ate it.
What's really poignant in this story is Zarif Khan. He's sort of the prime example of someone living the American dream. But then tragedy hits when he's visiting his homeland. What happened?
Yeah, this is a really sad story. So Zarif Khan ultimately married, had six children, was again very beloved in Sheridan. His whole family was beloved, and by account of those children, had really happy childhoods there. And he took that family back to Pakistan pretty much every year so that they could know their relatives there and spend time with them and know where they came from. And on his last trip back in 1964, and at this point, Zarif Khan is a very old man. He's 80 years old. He had always had this nephew who was, or great nephew, I guess, who was just a very troubled young man, by all accounts, kind of the black sheep of the family, someone who had always been difficult and prone to violence. And on that trip back, one of the things Zarif Khan was doing was giving away a lot of money and property. By this point in his life, he was quite wealthy. And this one troubled family member was unhappy with his portion, basically with his allotted share. And early one morning when Zarif Khan and a different relative were on their way to a neighboring village to buy a wedding present, actually, he waited for them by the side of the road and killed his great uncle. So very sadly, Zarif Khan died where he was born, 12,000 miles from the place that he ultimately would call home.
Was he buried in Pakistan or Wyoming?
Yes, he's buried in Pakistan, as was his wife when she died much, much later, just a few years ago in 2011.
Are any of Khan's family still in Sheridan today?
Yes, indeed. Two of his six children are still in Sheridan, and a great many Khan relatives are in Wyoming and kind of nearby areas, Montana, South Dakota, Colorado.
Is there still any business associated with tamales in the Khan family?
Sadly, there isn't. That family, his widow, quite remarkably, given kind of the very dire straits she found herself in after his death, his widow actually did open a cafe hotel, kind of a joint business after his death, and kind of found her own economic footing, and then ultimately liked the hotel end of that business better than she liked running the restaurant. And so now that whole family is pretty much in hotels in the region. And there's one daughter in Florida who now cooks as well. And so she's kind of carrying on the Zarif Khan legacy. But for the most part, it's carried on chiefly in the memories of all these people who kind of glaze over with joy when they think about those tamales.
Catherine Schultz wrote about Zarif Khan, also known as Hot Tamale Louie, for the current issue of The New Yorker. Thanks, Catherine.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We have just enough time for one more quick note before the break, and it's a musical note. This is the group Coco Funca from Costa Rica. Their music is a mix of island rock, reggae, soca, and calypso, sort of all rolled into one. Our show director, April Peavy, likes their sound, so we're sharing a bit of it with you right now. Music there from the Costa Rican group Coco Funca. Their new album is called Chucaro. To find out more about the songs we play on the show, follow us on Spotify. We have a playlist of all of our favorite music from the show each day. Just look for PRI's The World. News headlines are next, here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Swing Your Partner Round and Round. A group of school kids are attempting the biggest square dance ever. Many of them are Asian American.
We never heard of square dancing in India. This is totally new to us.
It's a new tradition. It's not bad to learn something new.
That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. A courtroom drama has gripped many in Minneapolis for the past few weeks. Three young Somali Americans stood trial on charges of plotting to travel to Syria to join ISIS. Last Friday, the three young friends were all found guilty. Minnesota Public Radio's Duahli Saikautau has been following the case and the reaction.
What was the hardest to watch during the trial was when the three former friends of the defendants, two who had already pled guilty to conspiring to travel to Syria, testified against the defendants. That's when there were whispers of alleged threats against the families in the court gallery. There was a scuffle outside the courtroom between the families. One Somali American woman was forced to the ground and detained. Another was banned from the courtroom. It was just, unprecedented security.
I know you spoke with Murad Muhammad. He was the defense attorney for one of the defendants. That defendant is Muhammad Farah. Here's what he told you about how he viewed these defendants.
None of these three kids had any intention or said anywhere in the hours of recorded conversations that were done by the undercover human source. Not a single person had any intention to hurt America. These kids had no clue how to leave the country. I mean, they were hatching plans that involved, putting themselves in shipping containers to get overseas. I mean, that's how childish these children were. They're laughing at these videos.
I mean, laughing or not, the videos tend to be very gruesome. Ultimately, did the trial teach us much about the state of mind of these young defendants?
Well, the prosecutors obviously will tell you that there was just an abundance of evidence to show what these young men were thinking, how they were plotting, and their repeated attempts to actually try to travel, from their attempts to go to San Diego, to travel through to Mexico, to try to go to Turkey. There were just many attempts, according to the prosecutors. But the family members and even court observers, people who had nothing to do with these young men or who weren't related, they were like, these young men were just being young men. They were pumping up themselves, talking about things that they probably shouldn't be. They were playing paintball, which the prosecutors had argued was training for war. You have prosecutors who are saying, look, the evidence is clear, and family members and community members saying, you know, not so much. They were just young kids who sounded and who giggled about watching videos.
Now, I know there's those in the Minneapolis community who thought the trial did some real good because it shook residents out of what some called denial. Here's U.S. Attorney Andrew Luger.
One obstacle to preventing terror recruiting in Minnesota is the persistence of ISIL. They are reaching out to our youth with a powerful but false message. But there is a second obstacle to stopping this recruiting: denial. It will take the entire community working with local, state, and federal government agencies to stop ISIL from recruiting more Minnesota youth.
Duahali, I'm curious, were the prosecutors able to draw any parallels between how they believe these three young men were being recruited and how previous Somalis had been successfully recruited and joined ISIS or some other terrorist group abroad?
Prosecutors tried to stay focused on the fact that these men were persistently trying to travel to Syria and focused pretty much on ISIS, which is why so many propaganda videos were shown. It was really more about what these young men were thinking in this moment and where they were headed. And that was the biggest question, is did they really just talk more than they meant to? And all talk and no action, basically.
And what kind of sentences could the three face?
That's the big money question, because U.S. District Judge Michael Davis, he's experimenting with this de-radicalization program, essentially sort of how can he try to give these youths a second chance? And maybe he'll put these three defendants in the group that's already pled guilty, or maybe he'll sentence them to 10 to 15 years for the crimes that they've committed. It's really hard to know because this is the first time that a case like this has included multiple defendants and at such a young age. But in the end, they could face life in prison.
Minnesota Public Radio's Duahali Saikautau, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The new Harry Potter play had its first preview today in London. The official premiere is next month. The play follows Harry and his friends as grown-ups, 19 years after the events of the last book. And it's already a sold-out hit. But there's controversy, too, over the casting of a black actress as Hermione Granger. Some fans have objected strongly. Author J.K. Rowling has replied by calling these critics racists. I asked Akua Jamfi to chime in. She's the founder of Britain's only database of black British talent in the arts.
First of all, I understand and I respect people being protective of their favourite characters. The Harry Potter series has been something that a lot of us have grown up with, the films and the books, so I understand. But for me, this is a different imagining of the story. They're older. It's on stage. It's a whole new tale. It's something that we don't know. None of us even know how this story is going to play out. So it would be different if it was the films, then next, you know, Harry Potter 6 or 7, and then all of a sudden Hermione's a black girl. So they need to chill out a bit.
Do you think J.K. Rowling was right to go so far as to say that her fans are being racist here?
If they're being racist, they're being racist. There's some nasty things have been said. So I'm sure she wasn't labelling all her fans racist, but calling out the trolls that are saying baseless comments and rude and basically racist comments, she's got every right. And I think J.K. has been really brilliant at stamping down on people that have unnecessary things to say. And it's about separating who are actually true fans who are a bit upset from the trolls who are just saying anything just because they read a headline and go with it. Probably a lot of the ones that are making all the noise aren't the ones who are actually going to spend money, buy a ticket and actually go to the theatre. As you said, they've sold out, broken box office records without even knowing what's going to happen. So that's an amazing feat. And obviously, NOMA hasn't turned people off, along with Sherolsky and then the massive diverse cast. It's amazing.
You're founder of the British Blacklist, which really keeps track and focuses on diversity in the arts, in British arts. Are you surprised that this has come up, this issue has come up yet again?
No, I'm not surprised at all. We have these bursts of energy around these things that, you know, pop up. It's headline news. It's Harry Potter, as I've said. Everyone loves it. It's a popular story. All this talk and discussion and debate and anger and, you know, fighting to get people equal opportunities in a place where equal opportunities shouldn't be a problem. Creativity, this is people's minds, imaginations. There should be no limitations. But unfortunately, there is. It's important this conversation keeps happening. What I find with running the British Blacklist, there's so much talent going on in this industry, and there's so much British black talent, speaking from what we represent, that are doing great things. NOMA getting this opportunity, this colorblind casting, is a great testament to her talent, great testament to people embracing new ideas and new thoughts and just not being restricted by boundaries and limitations. It's just, it's a great thing. The conversation needs to happen, but things need to change where it becomes less of a hoo-ha every time something different occurs and every time a black person is cast in a role that people are a bit surprised about or think shouldn't be. It needs to become a more muted conversation where people don't blink an eye when these things happen.
Why did you create the British Blacklist?
Well, about 3.5 years ago, I realised that in researching black entertainment, I couldn't find a concise hub where I could just click and find out what film was on, what play was on, you know, a documentation or an archive of things that were going on in the black industry. Building up the research and digging through all the stuff that I could find, I realized that British black arts was very under-celebrated. I could find more about African-American stuff than British black. So then that's where I started to build this idea around documenting every single person in the arts in Britain, which is a massive feat. And then also being a place where they can get championed and they can, you know, when we have big blockbuster films, before pre-Idris Elba, I should say, you wouldn't necessarily get the black actor that's in a film recognised. They wouldn't get an interview in the broadsheets. They wouldn't get maybe a spot on TV or news or something like that. So I thought, create the British Blacklist where we can speak to those British black talents that don't often get recognition, the creatives, the actors, you know, all the people, you know, front and behind the camera and on stage and stuff like that. And that's just what it was. It was just an evolution of an idea that I thought, instead of complaining about stuff not happening, how about I go out and do something and fix that problem?
Now, Akua, final question. I know you have a teenage daughter. Is she really excited about the Harry Potter play?
She's really excited. I can't wait to take her. She's grabbing my arm. Mum, when are we going to get tickets? When are we going to get tickets? So I'm hoping to get her down there as soon as possible.
Did you manage to get one of those tickets before they sold out?
Nope. So we're going to wait and see. Hopefully I'll be on the waiting list.
Akua Jamfi is the founder of the British Blacklist, which is the UK's only database of black British talent in the arts. Thanks a lot, Akua.
Thank you very much.
We're going to learn now about a place called Borneo Camp. It's probably the most exclusive Russian resort in the world, though it's not technically in Russia, and it's not exactly luxurious. There's a swimming pool, but the water temperature is just above freezing. And taking a walk outside requires an armed escort because of the polar bears. Borneo is built on an ice floe in the Arctic Ocean and only operates for 1 month a year. It's currently the best and cheapest jumping-off point to the North Pole, but getting there just got harder, as Alina Simone reports.
Every year in March, a Russian cargo plane takes off for the North Pole with an impossible-sounding mission: to airdrop a pair of tractor plows, 50 tons of equipment, and a landing crew on a moving chunk of ice just off the polar ice cap. Within a few days, they construct a tent city and carve out a runway in temperatures below minus 20 degrees Celsius. Borneo Ice Camp then opens for business, welcoming tourists and athletes who have spent a minimum of $20,000 just to reach the top of the world. Borneo is run by Russia, but to get there, you have to go through Norway. For a decade, Borneo has flown tourists out of the remote Norwegian settlement of Longyearbyen, but that working relationship just came to an end. See, Borneo is also used by the Russians to conduct military drills, activity that has stepped up significantly in recent years, and it's making Norway increasingly nervous.
The Russian government has kindly agreed to assist Norway.
This year, a Norwegian TV thriller debuted on Netflix called Occupied, about a dystopian future where the Russians assert control over Norway.
The storyline in itself in Occupied is a bit extreme, but But I think it definitely plays into this fear in, I mean, it's a nationalistic fear in Norway, right? That you're bordering Russia, and Russia has always been the big bad enemy to the east.
This is Andreas Ostagen at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies.
I think that's what the Norwegian government is fearing the most, that if they show too much of, let's say, weakness or unwillingness to actually respond to these Russian actions, then Russia sees that as a sign of weakness, or as a sign that Norway is not actually willing to step up and say, defend its part of the Arctic. So it seems to me a bit like a tit-for-tat game.
This year, the game began when Chechen paratroopers were dropped off at Borneo to conduct survival and rescue drills in early April. That's the sound of Chechens firing machine guns over the ice. Norway didn't come right out and publicly condemn the exercises, but they did cancel all of Borneo's remaining flight permits, and that threw the plans of tourists waiting in Longyearbyen into chaos, including 47 runners from around the world who had come to compete in the annual North Pole Marathon. Polar explorer Erik Larsen was among those left hanging.
It was just kind of this wild roller coaster ride of information where, okay, Get your stuff packed and get ready. We're going. Oh no, wait. There's this problem with the bureaucracy. And can you call this person to hopefully put some pressure on the Norwegian government?
According to Viktor Boyarsky, one of Borneo's founders, Borneo's staff had nothing to do with organizing the Chechen military exercises.
It was a kind of wrong impression.
But he also adds that the soldiers had a right to be there. After a couple days, Norway did lift the flight embargo on Borneo, allowing the North Pole Marathon to continue. But they also issued strict new flight regulations.
For us, it was difficult to accept this one.
Given the Arctic's volatile weather, Boyarsky says, flexibility is key. You just can't fly to the pole according to a rigid timetable. So at the end of this year's polar season, Borneo announced it's moving out of Norway. Those hoping to visit the North Pole via Borneo next year will have to go through a remote territory in Russia. Unlike traveling through Longyearbyen, getting there will require a visa. So is it time to cue the Occupied theme song? Andreas Ostagen says not yet. There's too much at stake for both Russia and Norway to risk their relationship. And he points out a lot of countries conduct military drills in the Arctic, including America. In the long run, though, it's probably global warming, not Cold War politics, that poses the biggest threat to Borneo. The ice floe supporting the camp snapped 4 times this year, causing greater delays than the Norwegians ever did. For The World, this is Alina Simone.
We have a ton of photos of everyday life on Borneo. We've even got one of the swimming pool there. It's just a few degrees above freezing. Catch those at PRI.org. Coming up, square dancing meets a new demographic at one California school. That story here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Fallujah is one of those places in Iraq that's highly symbolic for Americans. That's because so much American blood was spilled there trying to take control of the city. It was a shock back in 2014 when ISIS militants seized Fallujah. Now Iraq's military seems poised to take the city back from ISIS. But the situation is dire for thousands of civilians trying to flee the fighting. Hugh Naylor with The Washington Post was on the outskirts of Fallujah earlier this week. We reached him in Baghdad today.
So ISIS controls all of Fallujah proper, and storming directly into the city, or at least attempting to storm the city, are Iraq's military and elite counterterrorism forces, and they're generally trying to go in from the south. On the outskirts of town, helping to cut supply lines and surround the city, are pro-government, mostly Shiite militias. Now, Fallujah is sort of the center of Iraq's Sunni Muslim heartland, and having these Shiite militias involved, even in a peripheral sense, in the operations to take Fallujah, it could create for a pretty combustible situation given Iraq's sectarian politics. So I think people are on edge more so now than they have been before about what will actually happen there and how this will affect the broader campaign to drive Islamic State militants out of Iraq itself.
There's also some reports that the Shia militias are involved in some torture and abuse. How true are those allegations?
Well, it's unclear how true they are because the government is preventing the alleged victims from being interviewed or from being accessed by human rights workers as well as journalists. We interviewed several provincial councilmen from a suburb next to Fallujah who described to us systematic abuse, severe beatings, forced disappearances, and alleged executions. Now, we've not been able to independently verify this, but speaking to these individuals, as well as human rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch, I think there's serious concern of widespread abuse committed by these militias. And on the other hand, the Islamic State is also accused of committing horrendous human rights violations against the civilians, an estimated 50,000 civilians who are still inside the city of Fallujah itself.
We always hear about how critical Fallujah is in Iraq. How close are we to having ISIS routed from the city?
I think it's going to take some time for the militants to be driven out. You know, they've had over 2 years to fortify themselves and bring in lots of partisans and militants to protect the place. They've carved out lots of tunnels to wage surprise attacks. There's lots of sniper's nests. And a tactic they're increasingly relying on, according to pro-government forces who are fighting them, is just using civilians as human shields to kind of slow government advances. And so it's complicating the campaign there. So it's going to take some time to finish off the city, but it is completely surrounded. And I think it's only a matter of time until the militants are defeated there.
Hugh Naylor with The Washington Post. Thanks, Hugh.
Thank you very much.
Finally today, square dancing has become a big deal at a school in Union City, California, not far from San Francisco. So big, in fact, that the kids there, mostly Asian and Asian American, are trying to break a world record for the largest square dance ever. Reporter Hannah Baba has our story.
At Easton Elementary, 863 students plus 18 teachers and staff form themselves into squares of 8 dancers each.
If your square is not complete, raise your hand so we can see the square that needs people.
Ivan D'Souza, a.k.a. Mr. D, is the school's music teacher. He's perched above the students on a 15-foot crane in a cowboy hat holding the mic. In square dance lingo, he's the caller, and he's taught the dance for years. But today is different. The school is preparing to break the world's largest square dance record. It's currently at 800 dancers on the floor at once. This school now has 885 dancers gathered, which would beat the record by a lot. They've been practicing for months. Parents included.
I'm from India. We never heard of square dancing in India. This is totally new to us.
Kuki Srivastava is with a group of moms chatting. She's Indian, and so are many of the students here in this part of California. In fact, about 60% of Easton's students are from Asia or have parents from Asia. And like Srivastava, this is their first encounter with square dancing. But parent Ipshita Mohanty says they're up for the challenge.
It's a new tradition kind of thing, so it's not bad to learn something new.
Another parent, Shamsa Rafai, who's from Pakistan, is the timekeeper.
This square dancing unifies everyone. There are 8 kids in a circle, and they're all holding hands. They don't care who's by them. We love it.
The kids seem to love it, too. They had a practice run yesterday. So how'd it go?
It's crazy.
Yeah, it feels
very
crazy.
But fourth grader Brandon True doesn't quite get it.
Everybody was confused to do some things at once. It was hard.
Okay, so why square dance? Principal Carla Victor says it teaches social skills like acceptance and unity. And in a year when the national debate over immigration is especially loud, Victor says the school is challenging the idea of who's American and who isn't.
When we can come together on a common ground and do something collectively, it just shows what America really is and should be.
And what better to unify folks than a good old square dance? Mr. D looks at the hundreds of kids from his crane. He fixes his shades and cowboy hat and takes the mic.
Let's show them why we're here. Without talking, Stand and square your set. Square your set. Honor your partner. Honor your corner. Join hands, circle left.
Boys and girls swing their partners and promenade right and left for a good 5 minutes. TV crews are also on the scene. It's not just an everyday sight. And looking on proudly is Delaine Easton herself. She's California's first female state superintendent of schools, and this school is named after her.
Our families got here 400 years ago, but they came from somewhere else. America is a country of immigrants. This group of children who represent hundreds of destinations other than the United States of America in their ancestry will be the finest Americans.
All the way around, and please don't fight. Don't stay.
The kids do the dance twice. They gotta get it right. Then it winds down.
Honor your corner. Honor your partner. Square your set. You should be proud. I am. I'm a proud papa.
D'Souza then gets down from the crane and says they're now ready to submit their entry to the world record judges and wait for the news. For The World, I'm Hannah Baba, Union City, California.
I'm Carol Hills. That's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.